Support for KNKX's studio sessions comes from the University of Puget Sound, an independent liberal arts university. Through scholarly engagement and collaborative education, Puget Sound prepares students for careers in the arts, sciences, research, and entrepreneurship. More at pugetsound.edu.
Hello, I'm Abe Beeson with a third visit from our good friend from Brazil, pianist, well, multi-instrumentalist, composer, and bandleader Jovino Santos Neto. He joined legendary musician and composer Hermeto Pascoal in the late 70s. He was a key member of that band until he relocated to Seattle in the early 90s. Jovino has made a huge impact in the Northwest as a musician and as an educator for 26 years at Cornish College. He's just released a beautiful keepsake of his early days in town, a new album called Mais Que Tudo, live at Carey Hall 1995. In our studios today, he's joined by Ben Thomas on vibraphone. We have Tim Carey at the bass, Mark Ivester drums. Jovino will be leading a quartet at the Seattle Jazz Fellowship Friday and a trio on Jazz on J Street in Tacoma. That's coming up Saturday. Jovino's quintetto, including percussionist Jeff Bush, will be opening for the great flutist Nestor Torres and his band at Langston Hughes Performing Arts Institute October 31st for the Earshot Jazz Festival. And now, put your hands together for Jovino Santos Neto.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I think I just heard a police siren. Somebody pull them over. They're going way too fast. Jovino Santos Neto with Ben Thomas on the vibraphone. We have Tim Carey bass, six-string bass, beautiful stuff, Tim, and Mark Ivester behind the drums. Jovino's new album is Mice Que Tudo, live at Carey Hall, 1995. He'll be leading a quartet at the Seattle Jazz Fellowship Friday, a trio at Jazz on J Street in Tacoma Saturday, and the quintetto will be opening for the great flutist Nestor Torres and his band at Langston Hughes Performing Arts Institute October 31st. Be sure to bring a costume for the Earshot Jazz Festival show on Halloween. Big thanks to our KNKX Studio Sessions team, audio engineer Brian Moynihan, video producer Parker Blome, and promotions director Brenda Goldstein Young. I'm Abe Beeson. Thank you all so much for listening. And, okay. So I'm excited to talk about live performance with Jovino Santos Neto. Growing up in not only Brazil, but Rio de Janeiro, in my mind, I feel like there's got to be music coming out of the earth there. I wonder if you could tell us about your first experience seeing a live concert, or was music really on the streets and everywhere you went?
Yes. In a way, I was lucky to be born in an area of Rio that's not like the postcard area of Rio, so I'm not a guy from Ipanema. I'm a boy from Realengo, which is the west zone of Rio. It's still the city of Rio, but it's like 15 miles out west. And I'm still old enough that I remember that one of my first experiences actually was hearing the live music but not seeing it, because there was a kind of like an old band with tuba and the it was not a marching band, but it's the kind of band they used to play in the gazebos, like on Sunday nights for people to stroll around. And they rehearsed in a little room on my street, but just down one block. And I would walk and hear the music, and all I saw was a little window. And I was too scared to go up there, of course. But I always remember, that's one thing, that hearing that music of the beautiful instruments coming up from there, I say, wow, that's so cool. And the other thing, you cannot really say it was live, but I really grew up in the golden era of radio, which, since we are in a radio station, I think it's important to see how the formation of the audience in Brazil, because the radio stations that I used to listen to when I was a kid, they played everything. I heard from Frank Sinatra to Neil Sedaka to rock and roll, and eventually, you know, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Brazilian bands that copied the foreign bands as well. So that was, I have to say that even though I had no musicians in my family, you heard music every day.
Now, when you were growing up, how old were you when you were finally playing your own show and concert? And were you nervous about it?
I started taking piano lessons when I was 12, mainly because my sister was taking piano lessons, so I kind of liked there was a piano arrived in my house, and I was just fascinated by that big piece of furniture. And started to, you know, fool around with it. So I took about 6 months of lessons. Then I got bored with it because I was just starting to listen to the music that you heard on the radio, and so I continued on my own. Again, I don't know if it's luck or just the way it happened, but my father had a little tape recorder, so that's also the confluence of technology and music, all is part of it. And because of that, I could record the songs from the radio when I would just wait and go, whoop, and then I'll tape the music, and then I put it next to the piano. I could entirely by ear try to learn, and very soon at the age of 15, 16, I was in a band playing original music that we composed ourselves. So that was the beginning. And I understand that, totally appreciate some people that have stage fright and a few trepidation going on the stage and performing. For some reason, there's some guys who climb like the mountains. They don't have that fear. I mean, they have, but somehow they manage to climb that, you know, the straight like a gecko. I don't do that, but in a way, going on stage and performing, for me, I get excited, but not nervous. You know, it's a different, almost like, but not the same.
Now, one of your real key musical experiences was working with the late, great Hermeto Pascoal, who just sadly passed away last month, and I wonder if you could tell us what you learned from him about the live performance.
Well, I was actually trained as a biologist, so my goal in life was to be a scientist. So when I started to play with Hermeto, I came from a culture that believed that everything you could learn was in a book somewhere or is in a score somewhere. So everything depended on the sort of written style. And when I started to play with Hermeto, he completely not destroy those notions, but he showed me that there's another universe which can never fit in a book or can never fit into that kind of a structure, framework. So with Hermeto, we were like, my very first gig with Hermeto, I rehearsed for a whole week. And then we went to play a gig close to the Sugarloaf in Rio. If you know, the Sugarloaf is right, not on top of it, but the mountain next to it. And we didn't play any songs that we rehearsed. So that's what I mean. That kind of like, you know, putting you on the spot and then say, okay, what did it say in English? Throw you in the deep end. So you see if you can swim. And he did exactly that. And my first gig with him, but I was already pretty like this because I had no idea. And he tells me, go there and play. And I go, play what? He says, I don't know. You're going to play, not me. Go out there and play. So I went and started. There was a Rhodes piano and a clavinet. I started to play. And then the whole band go, boom, stopped and left the stage. And there's about 1,500 people in the audience. And I'm there playing. And I go, I don't remember what I played, of course. I had to play. And I played something. So that's what I mean. That kind of like, it's when everything that's like rational and planned shuts down because it's useless, and you just do whatever it is that your intuition. So Hermeto, I can say now in a few words that what Hermeto did was to teach us, all of us who played with him, to trust our intuition, because our intuition is never wrong. If you catch the first one, if you catch the second one, it's already the opposite. But if you can go to the source and drink that water from where it comes up, that's what it is.
Now, after several years with Hermeto's band, you came to Seattle and became an educator, quarter century at Cornish College. As an educator, how do you teach someone about live performance, about what to do when they get on stage?
Well, most of my teaching assignments were ensembles. So that was a good thing. There was an ensemble that used to be known as the Latin Jazz Ensemble, and eventually became the Latin Ensemble because we started to broaden our music in a very... And over these years, I cannot even count how many great musicians, including Mr. Tim Carey right there, who was my student at Cornish, and several other people with whom I play in town today have been my students, like Mo Eisner and Xavier Le Couturier. They're all students. Dylan Hayes, they're all students at Cornish, great musicians there. So I believe, and that's just my personal philosophy of how that education, we call it education because it fits inside of an institution. But in truth, it's bigger than that. And this is something that I learned. That's like there's this like current or like a stream of transmission of the musical wisdom or knowledge. And there's somebody right here who's pulling you to help you get to the next stage of whatever you're going. But you're not going to go unless you do this and bring somebody else to the next level. So to create that kind of like a human chain, and Hermeto too, he had people who taught him, and so he taught me in a way, and I'm teaching other people, and those people are teaching. So we are just part of that current, and if we are connected with that and we believe in that, it's no longer about the individual and the ego and me, you know, that kind of chest thumping thing. It becomes more of like you're so happy to be part of that river, you know, of music that keeps evolving.
The new live album, Mais Que Tudo, live at Carey Hall, 1995. That was a band made up of your fellow faculty members at Cornish. And I wonder if you could talk about putting that band together for, and I think that was your first show together?
It was actually our first public gig together. And when I came to Cornish as a student, and Chuck actually auditioned me, Chuck Dierdorf, he auditioned me, and that was September 1993. So by November, I had met Mark Ivester, and with Chuck and Hans Stoiber, we started to rehearse every Friday. I had no piano at home, so I had to go to, Friday afternoons, usually when the school had no classes. So we'd find an empty room, and we'd start to play. Then Chuck's room, Mark's room, my room, we had all this ability, and I started to write music. So a whole year of 1994 went through with me being super inspired to play, to write music for this quartet. And our first official gig, which I have to say thank you to Chuck Dierdorf for getting that gig at Cornish, was on April 28th, 1995. I know the date because it was my son's 13th birthday. And one of the tracks is actually a happy birthday for him that we surprised him there. So the fact that that was actually documented and what when I listen to it past 30 years later, is that I get blown away. It was like basically like you're cooking these beans in a pressure cooker and suddenly you go, you know, and the energy, like our very first chord of the very first song, which is also the first track on the record, we go, bah-nah. It's like it came out with such a power. It's actually distorted, kind of like a guitar, like a guitar chord. And that's so powerful, you know, because for me, it was like, you know, when they christen a new ship and they break like the champagne bottle, that was us. And that has never stopped. And I'm so grateful for, you know, sharing the stage with guys like Mark Iverson. Of course, Ben Thomas has been playing with us for how many years now?
20 now.
So we're all old, but not old.
And the record, 30 years old, that must have been quite a journey for those original tapes through the years, stuck under your bed, and then finally transferred to digital. When did you decide, let's put this out?
Somebody gave me a tape sometime after the show. John Burrow, actually, who recorded it. He now lives somewhere in Qatar, I believe. But anyway, he gave me the tape, and that I didn't have the machine to play that tape, so he went under my bed. So I literally slept on those tapes. I snored on them, and I dreamt on top of those tapes for about 15 years until 2010, when I was able to digitally transfer those digital videotapes to like the digital audio workstations we use nowadays. And again, I saved it again, and another 15 years went by, sleeping on top of the hard drives that had those things, until last year when, when you get this little, hey, how about those tapes? And I go, where are they? And I go, I found them on my hard drive. And the rest is history, because then, you know, my son-in-law, Michael Shanks, he mixed them, and then we had them mastered, and it came out on Origin Music. So we're very happy to have that music out for everybody to hear.
Now, one of the things about live music that a lot of people don't really take into account is how important the audience is. Oh, and I wonder if you could talk more about what you get from the audience when you're on stage.
Well, it's one of those, it's like a boat, right? So if you have a boat and you have everybody on one side of the boat, I saw the Titanic, I know what happens there. It's kind of like the boat is totally, so I think that the audience and the band, it's not a tug of war, but it's a balance. Because if we are generating all this energy and the audience is there looking at their phones or just completely abstract or having a very interesting conversation about I don't know what, it's not that this disrespectful. Sometimes it's actually good when the audience is not paying attention, because we penetrate in the subconscious. Like we get to, like they hear the music, but they don't know they're hearing it. But I mean, today here we have a fantastic audience that is listening. Yeah. That creates a kind of like a resonance. So we play every note that Ben plays, that Tim plays, or that I play, bounces back and returns to us. So we as musicians, we are sensitive to that energy that returns. And then when the thing starts, then it becomes like a ping pong game, you know, but nobody wins. It's just, we're not counting points. We're just having fun in bouncing that ball back and forth. And for me, that's what it is.
Now, something I think about in the audience, and I'm sure my friends in the audience here do as well, when you go to a concert and you're waiting in your seat and there's nobody on stage, what's happening backstage? What's going on? Are they preparing? Are they going through notes? Are they just having a beer? What do you do? What is your pre-show ritual? Is there one?
We tell stories.
Yeah.
We tell all kinds of stories, and I love telling stories. I think the ability to, because I learned so much from hearing older musicians telling stories. I had the opportunity to travel with Dizzy Gillespie a couple of times, and the stories that Dizzy told me are amazing. So I hope that now that I'm older too, and that I can tell the stories, and people go, did this really happen? Said, yeah, I saw them with these eyes here. That really happened. So I think the telling of stories and laughing and the amount of jokes, they're usually drummer jokes, but not always, you know. But it's the kind of thing that, for me, I think relaxes. You know, the people have, and I respect if people have different rituals, because there's always a ritual. I think the stage itself is a ritual. So I think it's not the time to try to practice, because 5 minutes before the show, you're not going to learn anything. So you have to just relax and say, a performance is a snapshot. like you take a picture. If I take a picture a year from now, I'm going to look a year older. So if I play a year from now, I'm also going to play a year older. So respecting, like we have a record that's 30 years old. So I was 30 years younger. And I listened to that, and it could be, oh, today I would do this and that different. Maybe I'll play it a little more subtle here or a lot. So it's you just realize the reality of time, because that's what music is. It's the art of time. So when we look at how time, all the things that change and all the things that don't change, and for each one is going to be different. So that realization for me is the biggest thing.
And on the other side of that, what happens when you're done performing, when you've finished your encore and you go backstage? Do you talk about the performance, or do you talk about the audience, or do you talk about the venue, or what is your process when it's all over?
I have people coming up after the show and say, hey, that song that you played after the break, and I go like, I don't remember. So to try to recall, and even if there's a recording, I cannot listen like this, the proof of that is a recording that I listened to it 15 years later and then 15 years after that. I need time. I think we need time to forget. Mm. And then when you listen to it, it's like you sampling it again for the first time. And then you can be more objective, because every time, like when you are in the studio recording, so all three records I have this year coming out, they're all live. So it's like, and there's no overdubs. We didn't go back and fix anything. It's just, it is kind of like it's the portrait, but without the makeup, without, the filters, the Instagram filters. So in a way, I like that kind of honesty. And are there mistakes there? Oh, yeah. And that those are really what make the human. There's a lot of machines that try to make things down. They try to be on hold on the telephone, and you hear some stuff, and it's like, what is that? You know, there's no mistakes in it, and that is very troubling.
Let's hear it one more time for these four wonderful humans. Gabino Santos Neto, Tim Carey, Ben Thomas, Mark Ivester. I'm Abe Beeson. Thanks again for listening. Yay!
Thank you.